So I was like, it just, fuck it, I'll endure it, whatever it is. They want to hit me, let them hit me. I don't care. I don't want to be poor. I'm not going to make any excuses why I can't do something, you know? I'm going to come up with a reason why I can do it.
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another Smarter Destiny podcast, where I'm honoured because today we are joined by Pejman Gadimi, or PJ for short, and I'm definitely going to be going with PJ. So PJ gave me a brief summary of the things that he does, and that brief summary took about 5 minutes, and that's because he's got his finger in a lot of pies. So whether it's the amazing flash cars that he's got, the watches, and the lifestyle that accompanies it, with a sort of entrepreneurial hack behind that, which we're going to get into. That might be something that takes your fancy. It could be that his businesses generated over $80 million last year. That might wet your whistle. It could be that you've seen him on Netflix on his car show, or you are part of one of his companies, or you've read one of his 12 books, three of which were bestsellers. PJ is all over the place. He's immensely successful, which is why I'm honoured and gratified to welcome him on the show today. PJ, how are you?
Good, buddy. How are you? I appreciate you having me on today.
I'm doing good, thank you, and thanks for being on. Whereabouts in the world are you right now?
I'm in Florida, in South Florida, 20 minutes from Miami.
Lovely. And what kind of building are you in right now, which is a weird question.
I am in my man cave, meaning I've built this place. It's a two-level, literally, hangout place for whenever I want to get away from the office, but I want a side place that's like almost a second office that stores 15 cars, art, and, of course, just hangout stuff like air hockey and stuff that's like behind me.
Nice.
But basically, it's just a hangout spot that I've created for myself, like about 2 miles away from my main house, so that way I can still go somewhere if I don't want to be home.
Sounds good to me. So those of you listening, it's definitely an excuse to find the video version of this episode, because it's well worth seeing the man cave that PJ's got going on. So PJ, we had a little discussion just before we came on air, and we sort of landed on a great starting point for your journey. And so to tee up the start of your story and the start of your journey, have you always been an immensely successful entrepreneur? Perhaps you came from wealth, super rich, you know, given the golden dummy?
The complete opposite. I mean, we were rich in Iran when I was born, but 3 years after my birth, the revolution occurred, and we ended up fleeing to France as refugees with no money. So went from living this huge, very lavish lifestyle that my mom had created with her job and everything, and to like massive poverty in France. And we did that for 11 years and kind of got back on our feet to a degree where we actually could afford a car and an apartment after 11 years, and got a chance to come to the United States and finally found a way here again, poor, you know, but still better to be in the States poor than to be in France, you know, middle class. So we got to the United States, and after 2 short years, we thought we were going to do really well. We moved to L.A. and reality kicked in again. We didn't have papers. We didn't have an opportunity to do anything. I was still a child by then. Like, I was in my like 12, 13 years of age. And what ended up happening basically is that we ended, long story short, we ended up from California ending up in Virginia to my uncle's basement, which wasn't a decent neighborhood, but still just a basement, where me, my uncle, and my mom were now stuck in a studio basement. And at that point, it seemed what would be indefinitely. So, you know, I came from a very kind of poor background and kind of raised to a degree where I couldn't really afford much. And I didn't really have an opportunity to work either, because I had no green card. I had no papers that said I was allowed to work or anything else. So everything I did was really, at that point, was more like, hey, I have no choice. What do I have to do to like do something, you know? And when I realized my mom wasn't going to be able to give me the life that I wanted, she had already done her deed by bringing me here. I thought that I had to step up and do something to kind of contribute, because I remember that specific point when I was in Virginia. I was in a basement, and we had little windows in the basement, you know, the tiny ones that are on top of it, so you can barely see out the street level. And I used to see these kids go to school in the morning, their Camaros and Mustangs and stuff. And I was like, fuck, this is like crazy. These kids are like 16 and driving $30,000 cars, you know, and I'm like sitting here and I have nothing. Like, I don't even have a bed or desk or anything. So I was like, this is completely fucked. So I was like, I'm tired of waiting around to see if this changes. And I couldn't work. So I went to McDonald's, begged them to give me a job for $3 an hour to clean their floors. And they told me to fuck off. They were like, you don't have a green card, so you can't work. So I was like, fuck, okay, so I can't work. So then I started cleaning cars in the neighborhood and doing lawn maintenance, whatever I could find, you know, for any dollar. And I was really good at cleaning cars, and I started charging $5 a car, which was like literally poverty status. Like, we couldn't even do anything with $5. But I thought the way I thought about it was $5 was better than no dollars. So I'd rather make $5 every 2 hours than no money, right? So I said, let me go do that. And I did that through the winter, through the summer. It didn't matter how cold it got. I was still washing cars. And as a result of it, kind of got so good at it that I started doing so many that things got better and better over time, you know?
Nice. And so you initially started that because you wanted to contribute to your family. Did you say it was your mum and your uncle?
My uncle was temporarily staying there with us because he also had an issue in LA when he moved from LA to Virginia with us. And then he eventually moved out and we kind of stayed there.
Nice. And so you're now, word spread around the neighborhood that you're an awesome car cleaner. Your wax is the best wax. And
I sucked at that. But what I was good at is the fact that I was always available because I wasn't doing anything after school, right? So I was always working and I was always willing to wash. And that's why people called me for $5. Some people felt bad for me. They gave me $10 and stuff. But The point was that I was doing whatever I had to until I was still looking for a job. I couldn't find one. And then one day I got lucky. I was in high school. I was in the cafeteria. And these two guys were completely stoned out of their ass, like completely retarded. They were offering jobs, you know, at a desk. And they were like, hey, we're doing customer service jobs. And they seemed to be like really drugged up. So I was like, I don't think these guys like know what the fuck's going on. So I just walked up, tried to get try to see what the inquiry was, what are they offering, et cetera. They didn't tell anybody it was telemarketing jobs, which are the worst. You know, you call people, you get hung up on them in 5 seconds. But I didn't care, right? I was washing cars for $5. I was averaging a car every hour and a half. So I was technically making like $3.50. These guys were offering like $12 an hour. So I was like, let me hear what they have to say. And I obviously realized that they weren't going to give me a job either once they found that I didn't have a green card. So what I did is I found a little cute little quick loophole is I ran over to the administration office and I got a work permit. And then I pretended that I didn't have my actual green card, but I would have it later. So seeing how like their state of mind was, I was like, they're probably just not even going to remember. So I got a job as a telemarketer at 14, which was, you know, I was 14 and a half about when I started. And it was probably the greatest decision in my life that I've ever taken or the greatest chance I've ever taken trying to get a job without legally being able to work at the time, you know. So I took this job and it sucked, obviously. My first customer's name was Mr. Black Dick. It was horrible. Like, no joke, everything was like so fucked. Like, from the first day I like stepped there, I kept getting hanged up on, yelled at. And it didn't matter because to me it was 12 an hour versus, you know, 3.5 an hour, right? So I was like, it just fuck it, I'll endure it, whatever it is. They want to hit me, let them hit me. I don't care. I don't want to be poor. I'm not going to make any excuses why I can't do something. You know, I'm going to come up with a reason why I can do it. So I stayed extra. I learned. I talked to other people who were successful in that office, and I figured out how to sell windows and siding. Like, I was a remodeling company, and I figured out how to do that on the phone. So once I got good at it, I went from making my little $12 an hour to making $2,500 a week in commissions, which was a really big deal for, you know, at the time I was almost 16. And now you're like talking about $2,500 a week. That's 10 grand a month. You have to understand that 10 grand a month then was a lot of money. And 10 grand a month to a 16-year-old today is a lot of money, you know? Like, so yeah. It was just such a big deal that I didn't take it for granted. I worked, you know, I kept killing it. And I was like, I'm never going to like just kind of fall back from that. And I just kept going. And by 18, I was the director of that company. I had gotten a green card by then. So, you know, I had been promoted like 4 times. And I was the only one that literally was running the entire sales department and everything else for that company. And at 18, I decided I had a green card then and I was legal to work. And I decided that there was no upside to the job I had, meaning there was nowhere further I was going to go. So I decided I needed to learn how to make real money. And then, however, by then, you know, now I was making almost 80K a year. I was extremely comfortable, you know, because I had nothing before. Me and my mom were at least taken care of. We had just picked up a home. So basically, I was now running my household, right, at like 18. And I decided that I wanted to go to college, but I couldn't afford to go to college while if I gave up my job, if that makes sense, because I couldn't actually give up my job and it was a full-time job. So I decided I wanted to go where the next best step is, which is where I'm going to learn how to make even more money, which was a place I had no idea about. Most people were like, oh, I want to start a business. I want to do this. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. So because I had no idea, I figured what I wanted to do was work around money. So I decided I'm going to go work in a bank. And I'm going to figure out how money works in and out because I didn't know anything about it. And remember, we live in an era where today you guys have the internet for everything you need. You know, we didn't really like use Google the way you guys use it today. We didn't have as much information online. So things were different, right?
So when you say, you know, it was a long time ago, what year are we talking around about?
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you. So basically, I grew up in an era where smartphones weren't around, right? So in order to get the internet, you had to be sitting at home on a desktop. Meaning you really didn't have like these browsers and your phone doing what your computers do. So it was just worth, I mean, this was what, like 2000, I graduated high school in 2000. So it was like 2000, 2001, right?
Okay.
So, you know, we had resources, but I didn't have access to resources the same way you guys have today. And so what ended up happening is by doing that, basically, I just decided, I was like, I'm going to go work at this bank. And I'm going to figure it out, right? I'm going to figure out exactly like how money works and I'm going to see if what makes sense or what doesn't make sense, you know? And so I ended up going, I got into banking at 18. I became the youngest bank manager in the United States at 18. That was my accomplishment because I didn't have a degree. It was a big deal. It took 6 months to convince three people to hire me. But I eventually did, and that gave birth to my biggest career, which was in banking, where I went from 18 to 25 years of age. And in my 23rd years of age, I became the youngest executive vice president for a bank, and I created airport banking for that bank in Washington, D.C. So I did that, and then at 25, I got fired for being a dick and driving my Lamborghini and parking it over a handicap spot and telling my boss to go fuck himself. Apparently, that wasn't a good idea. So
yeah,
the cockiness got to me a little bit. You know, it wasn't a good idea. Apparently, you still have to be polite towards people you work with. And long story short, after I got fired, I was already pretty well off. Like, I had money in my pocket because I had this great job. I had saved money. I had some real estate holdings. So I was doing really good financially. But something really important happened in my life where someone took away my purpose. Meaning someone came to me and said, hey, you can't be a banker anymore. And we're going to fire you, right? Like, and so when they took that away from me, what happened is my job was so high up, meaning position-wise, that I couldn't duplicate it. Meaning I couldn't be like, oh, well, I'm just going to go and get another job at another bank the same way. And I don't have a degree, but it'll be fine. They'll just hire me. The only bank that could vouch for me wouldn't vouch for me anymore, right? And so the point was that I was kind of in this place where I was like, when they fired me, they took away my career. So they didn't take away my money because I was okay. The basic point was they took away what I could do and what I was really good at. And I got really scared about that because I was like, I don't know what to do now because I can't be a banker anymore. You know, and you can't really start your own bank like immediately and be like, oh, I'm going to just find $300 million and start my own small bank and we'll figure it out. So it wasn't a job where I could say, like, screw my boss. I'm just going to go and put him out of business, you know?
Absolutely. And so I want to delve in. So I can already see a shift here. And I think this is a great sort of teasing point. Sorry, audience. But I think there's something important that I want to drill into here. Now, at the telemarketing company, you came in, you know, at the lowest level because some drugged up drunk guys or whatever kind of fucked up and let you in somehow. Right. But then you rose to the top. OK. And then you transitioned over to a bank. And rose to the top, okay, and becoming the youngest bank manager. Now, that's a pattern, right? That's happened twice. So I'm curious, what is it about, or what did you take away from that experience about your attitude or attributes that really led to you rising up the ranks and becoming that top spot over other people? What did you do different?
So, a couple of things, right, to be fair. I don't give a fuck about anything. I think that was a big part of what made me. successful doing or working a job. You see, most people go work a job and they feel like they have rights or they're entitled to, like their position matters, their status matters, their title matters, right? They get embodied in the whole like idea of like, I'm a director of this, I'm that, I have authority, I have that. And I just don't give a fuck. I think that's what makes me really successful in everything I do. Like, one of the basic premises of being successful in telemarketing was that you needed to make calls, you know? And the other telemarketers were just so excited about sitting there and talking about their day and shit. And I was like, we're paid $12 an hour to make calls. Every call I miss an opportunity to make money. I'm here to make money. I'm not here to have a good time. And I think one of the big issues with the people that were in that office, everybody wanted to have fun while they worked. They were excited about the culture that was created for them. They were excited about the people they worked for. And I didn't give a shit. I was sitting there and I said, if I don't make this work, I'm not going to have any money. I care about the fact that there's a phone in front of me and I have a lead list to call and I have to close sales. That's what I'm here for. I'm not here to have a good time. I'm not here to have lunch, dinner, feel good, take a break. I'm here because I need to make these calls so that I can make sure I don't go back to cleaning cars. So one of the things that I've always ran away from as a child was poverty. I hated poverty. And unlike most people who don't like being poor, I was not a victim of the idea of being poor. I understood that being poor was a choice. And that as long as I could do something, it was better than doing nothing. And I think that attitude carried in banking as well. I didn't have any banking experience when I got hired as a bank manager. What I had was an opportunity to not give a shit about the potential guarantee or loss that came with it. Meaning that when I wanted to become a bank manager, everybody said, you're crazy, you're 18, you're never going to become a bank manager. Who's going to hire a bank manager at 18? I spent 6 months observing banks after hours while I had my telemarketing job until I understood how they worked, who was doing sales, who was who. Every single bank that I could possibly work at, so I knew every manager, I knew everything. Now, I had no guarantee I would work there. I didn't even have a guarantee I would have an interview. But the basic point was the research I put into, the effort I put into it was not based on the guarantee that I would get a job. It was based on the idea that I wanted a job. And you see, the one thing that happens for a lot of people is they go to work believing in other people are going to make them successful. They don't understand that they are the reason they're going to be successful. So they have to believe in themselves. You see, I believed in myself that I would be a banker, and I believed that to the core of me. So I was willing to put in the work to actually prove someone, one person, right, so that they would actually make me a banker, right? And then what happened is that part of the reason why I got promoted so fast was because I also understood, instead of looking at it as, well, now I'm a banker, I'm a bank manager, it's cool, everybody, like, I'm like prestigious and I have a company car and all that shit at 18. Instead, I looked at it very differently. I said, wait a minute, like, I was given an opportunity to be a bank manager without a degree, without previous experience, like in banking, right? I had sales, service experience. Those were the things that really were the catalyst for me getting hired. But I said, I don't have a direct line to being successful, you know, like meaning here, like I'm just given an opportunity on chance. And I have to make sure whoever took that opportunity on me is proven right so they can take it again next time. So I stayed longer. I stayed later. I got in earlier. And for what? Only to learn everything I should have learned the last 5 years because I wasn't in banking. And people said, well, you're not getting paid overtime. I said, I don't care. They said, well, wait a minute. You're not going to get any of your bonuses. I don't care. I was only there because I understood that I had to catch up. And again, this I don't give a fuck attitude about my feelings is one of the reasons why I'm always very successful at what I do. Because when I got fired from banking too, right, I went back to washing cars. And what's actually funny is a lot of people go, well, wait a minute. The guy who's now driving a Lamborghini wearing a $2,000 suit is going back to washing cars? Of course, because I didn't have something else to do. And I wasn't too proud to be like, well, that's not what I do. I'm PJ and I have all this money. Instead, I said, I don't have a purpose. And instead of sitting here and dwelling on the fact that I don't have a purpose, I'm going to make my life purposeful and I'm going to do something instead of sitting here and just looking and holding my dick in my hand. I'm going to go and do what I know how to do. And I knew how to wash cars. But what I did say is I'm not going to do it the same way I was doing it for $5. Right? I'm smarter now. I know things. So I'm going to buy a building. We're going to open a car wash, meaning we're going to open a detail shop and we're going to get there. And as a result, the same guys that were keeping up with my car washers when I got a job and started kind of moving up the ladder and not no longer doing that, those guys were still washing cars. And I brought them back with me. And I was like, listen, let's get a building. Let's detail cars. And we'll figure it out. And they're looking at me like, what do you mean we'll figure it out? I'm like, fuck it, I have money now. We'll figure it out. Like, we're not We're not going to like be like stuck in this mode where we're only washing cars for cheap money. You know, we're going to offer more services. We're going to do things. I have connections to people in town now. We can do things. And they were like, okay. And I was like, okay. And on a handshake, we built the infrastructure to what became later VIP Motoring that, you know, like about 8 years, no, 6 years later after that, made like $40 million in its annual revenue on the basis that we started just washing cars.
Wow. So, you parked your Lamborghini across a disabled space. Your boss didn't like it. You didn't like your boss telling you didn't like it.
It was more than that, right? Like, that's the easy way to get out of it. The basic premise of it was that I fired myself by just not being a jerk. The jerk part was just because I didn't give a shit. The part that was, that I realized one day is I looked out the window. And I realized that I had two Lamborghinis during my banking years. One of them was orange, one of them was silver. The orange one was parked one time and I was across like the executive parking lot where there was like a bunch of Lexuses and, you know, Mercedes and those kind of like sedans. Everybody drives a black or silver sedan. And there I am with a bright ass orange Lamborghini in the middle of like 14 executive sedans, you know? So I'm looking around and I'm like, these fucking people, I'm like, these guys are retarded. Why did they drive these shitty like sedans when they could have a Lamborghini or something, right? And I'm like sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, these guys just don't get it. Like, they just don't get it. And I think one of the biggest mistakes I had made then is thinking that they didn't get it, when in reality, it wasn't them. I was the one that was sticking out. I was the one that didn't fit in. So I was the issue. You know what I mean? And as the issue, I didn't realize that I was indirectly slowly removing myself from the equation, because what I was doing was getting so pissed at the fact that these people didn't get me, that I started acting out like I would go to work at 11, leave by 2 o'clock, no longer give a shit. Like, when my boss called, I was like, whatever, I'm not picking up the phone, I don't give a shit. So it just became this chain reaction, and I was extremely high paid. And I believe that forever in my head, I was like, listen, As long as I'm putting in my numbers, what are they going to complain about? I'm making them a ton of money. Like, what are they going to complain about? Like, what the fuck do they care if I'm at work at 10 a.m. or like 12? But I think they just started realizing that I didn't care, and they leveraged everything that I did to myself against me. You know, they were like, well, this guy, look, he's not a fit. So the first opportunity they had to walk me out, they walked me out. You know, they were like, hey, well, this isn't a fit for you anymore. Have a good day, you know? Mm. And so I think that's really the core of it. It was the attitude shift from, these guys don't get it. That's how I felt. That's when I stopped caring, when in reality, I was the one that had checked out, you know?
Yeah. And so you went back to what you knew, but on a bigger scale, and you built out this car business over the next 6 years to be a $40 million business. And presumably at some point, you also enjoyed the fact that there was no boss now, right?
Most people hate working for others, right? And I've never believed that we ever work for others, no matter what position we hold in what company. Think about it. Like, you go to work, you get a wage, right? You get paid something. You're told you get paid, for example, $50 an hour. That's a good wage, right? You're like, okay, I have some kind of skill. I'm paid that. Well, you're not working for people. You're taking direction from people. But you're the one earning your wage, meaning you're trading your time and skill for money, right? Like, you're accepting that openly. No one is forcing you to do that. Mm. It's not like in the army where you work for someone, right? Like, you're told you have to do something and you don't have a choice. Here, in this case, you're choosing the skill you're trading, and you're choosing the amount you're capable of accepting for that skill. So when you don't have talent in the world, you trade time for money. And when you trade time and skill for money, your wage goes up. But in the end, you're always the one benefiting from the wage. If the wage wasn't there, you wouldn't work. So therefore, you're only working for your own benefit. You're never working for the benefit of others. So that's why I think a lot of people get confused about, oh, I need to be an entrepreneur, I don't want to have a boss. You never have a boss. You just assume you have a boss because you're incapable of showcasing your own talents without someone giving you direction. So that's why you take a job. What ends up happening, though, is people get stuck in this loop of a job because they never cultivate their talent. A job is only there to help you cultivate a talent. Once you understand your talent, then your job is to actually now leave and figure out how to take this talent to the next level. Most people don't know what their talents are, so they can't create a business because they don't know what they're going to do. Most people don't even know what their skills are. They only relay their skills to the job they have. They go, I was a banker. That's what I know how to do. They don't think that, oh, I have sales skills. I have leadership skills. I have these skills. I'm going to try to sell cars instead of banking. You know, it's the same thing. I just need to do it a different way. So they're not in control of the ownership of their time. They just keep selling their time to the highest bidder. As a result of that, they realize at some point that there are no more bidders for the type of skills they have. And since they didn't cultivate a talent, they feel stuck. And then they're stuck in that position 10, 15 years, and they're not doing anything.
That's interesting. That's a very refreshing way of
right. And so I hated, to answer your original question, I hated working for myself. I mean, think about it. I had $250,000 salary, $1 million bonus. I had 8 weeks of vacation, and I came to work whenever I wanted when I was in banking. Now I had no money. I had to figure out how to make money. I had to use my money. I wasn't going to make $250,000 for the next 5 years. And in addition to that, I had no bonus and no paid vacation. Why the fuck would I want to work for myself? This was so much more fun when I was working in banking because I wasn't doing shit. And I had all these hot girls that I was hiring as tellers and everything. It was great. Like, so all these things were happening, right? And then I had all of these things happening. But like now I had this company where I couldn't even take a piss without losing money. So like I was like, this is horrible. And reality is most people are so eager to go work for themselves. And I was like, holy shit, I wish I could go back to banking. This was so much easier. But one of the things I learned really quickly was that the freedom didn't come from the money I was making or the time I was having. The freedom really came from the peace of mind that once I was going to be done building it, no one could take it away from me. And when, like I said, when I got fired from banking, they took away my purpose. That was the key. And I didn't want to let them, I didn't want to let anyone else control my purpose again. So I said that even though this wasn't my purpose to build a car wash, I was being purposeful at the time and no one could take that away from me again, you know?
I like that. And so presumably over that time, you began to get a little bit more clarity on what your purpose was. And at some point you moved on from the day-to-day being in the car wash business and moved on to the next thing. What was that next thing?
So, well, it wasn't really a moving on. We evolved that car wash business from basically a detail shop, right, which was a small detail shop just doing basically just cleaning exotic cars and luxury cars, to going into a tuning shop, meaning same location. We started doing customization to exotics and everything else. We got pretty popular for that. And then during the recession, the Great Recession that occurred, we started focusing on acquiring distressed assets, which were exotic cars, and turning them into investments for the same people that were investors with me back at the days at the bank that were not going to actually be able to make investments in a bank because everybody was afraid to put any money in banks. So what happened is we created this investment model at the time, and the same company just evolved 4 or 5 times until it gave birth to our entire concierge service called VIP Motoring, which was an alternative asset management company that enabled people to invest in exotic cars while having access to a 5-star concierge service that gave them the ability to buy cars, as well as maintain them, customize them. And then, of course, we went into watches, art, and all of these other things that are interrelated. And so it was about 2009, where we became very profitable. In 2011, we were doing about like $70 million in revenues. I stopped, assigned the CEO, which was one of the guys that was working and washing cars with me from the beginning. And then I kind of stepped away from that and started taking one of my blogs. I had started writing a blog called Secret Consulting. And that blog was basically like a bunch of business advice, etc. And this wasn't an era where blogs were popular, interviews were popular like today, podcasts didn't exist. Basically, what I did then was just create this model where I was just doing basically like the stories of people who owned exotic cars and what they did for a living. You know, everybody was like, oh, well, how do you afford your car? You're so young. You know, like, what do you do? So I started doing stories of me and my friends, and people really liked it. They started reading it. I launched that in 2008, really just did it part time as a kind of side hobby. In 2011, I realized it was getting serious. And so I started launching the rebirth of that called Secret Entourage, along with exotic car hacks and Watch Trading Academy as side things that were just being born then. But Secret was starting to gain some serious steam, and I started writing books and kind of gave birth to my online side of my business. which was completely unrelated, but it was just the online idea that I just wanted to be in a world where I didn't have overhead, and I believe that there was a huge business model online that people weren't understanding. And in the simplest model, I'll tell you this. So if I make $100 million in my investment company and I take home a $2 million salary, that sounds fantastic to some people because they only hear the you're taking home $2 million. But to me, it's like a huge liability because it's 98% fucking bullshit. Versus I'd rather just be in a business like online where I'm making $7 million a year, but six of that stays in my pocket. Right? It's a lot less liability, it's less employees, it's less issues, it's less overhead, it's more flexible, more adaptable, and faster to scale or get or change directions in. So I knew that in 2008 that the world would change. I knew in 2008 that things would be different online. So I decided that it was going to take a five-year learning curve to learn how to be successful online. So I would start then, and I was correct. In 2013, everything started blowing up. My book started becoming extremely famous. It was called Third Circle Theory. It was a book about awareness, self-awareness, and how the human mind evolves. And so a lot of people were getting into that level of conversation about awareness. And as a result of it, all my brands started blowing up, and that gave birth to me, the persona online, you know?
Like PJ. PJ was born online.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, actually, that's the best way to put it. PJ was born to a state where people recognized him, you know, not just made money in silence behind closed doors.
And so that's really, really, really smart. And it's people love talking revenue, right? They love talking revenue. It seems to be some judgment yardstick. And yet, like you said, you know, 100 million revenue when you're only actually taking home 2 mil is 98 million worth of bullshit, as opposed to your digital business, whereby it's got much better margins. But I want to go back to, when you started talking about, buying up distressed assets, in this case the cars, but you said it's a very similar process for watches and art and so on. Now I'm sure a lot of the listeners can understand how, you know, art can be a good investment piece. That's a lot more traditional. But in terms of cars, I think it's drummed into people, and I'm sure we're about to learn that it's incorrectly drummed into people, that cars are a liability. So could you tell us a little bit about how your business worked and these cars actually became investment?
So, yes. So cars are liabilities. We know that, right? So that's what we're taught from a very young age. But that was very true 20 years ago. And the number of cars on the road, the way car manufacturers built cars, the cost of manufacturing, all of these things meant that cars became liabilities, depreciation. So many things happen, right? It wasn't just one-sided. It wasn't just like saying, it wasn't like a broad sword, like saying this happens, that happens, this doesn't happen, etc. It was very much just saying like, listen, if you buy a car, most likely it's going to depreciate to zero and it's going to keep breaking down and you're going to have all these issues. If we follow the rule of thumb from 20 years ago, then that still holds true. However, manufacturing, engineering, the way things are working in the automotive world, the production levels, the types of cars, everything has changed today. So cars are no longer, not all cars are depreciating assets. Cars today depreciate even faster than before for some of them, but some of them now have become collectible for some others, and cars in general have become a prize, a status. So there's so much more that goes into it. I mean, to give you just context, think about it this way. If Lamborghini produced 200 cars a year, you know, 20 years ago, it now produces like 100 cars a week. You know, like, so think about that. Like, I mean, imagine how much more money is in the world now that a manufacturer like Lamborghini can make 6,000 units a month, you know, versus it was making 250 a year. So what I'm trying to say is, like, when you're looking at it that way, then you start realizing that the rules that govern the old days can't govern today, especially not if there is such a difference in production level and why people are buying this car and how much money is in the world. So as a result of that, the rules of engagement today are very different than they used to be. And so today we have such a better and bigger opportunity to understand that if there is supply, if there is demand, and there's going to be a curve that changes, as a result of that, there's going to be an opportunity for investment. The same happens with housing today. The same happens with cars and art and watches. It's the same exact model. When you have a lot more money, people want a lot more stuff. And when you don't have the production levels, people pay more stuff. You know, so it changes the dynamic of the old days.
So So let me see if I'm getting this straight. So one way that the right car might appreciate in value is if there's enough people out there really wanting a Lamborghini, but there just aren't Lamborghinis available. And so it gets into us almost like a bidding war for the Lamborghinis
right,
that are
exactly.
available.
Exactly, except that we're not talking about a Lamborghini in the generality like the old days. We're talking about a specific model, a specific color, a specific way. That car will hold its value or go up. Not all cars will.
And so, yeah, not all cars are. I'm sort of thinking, yeah, so the Ford pickup truck. No, so...
But not even all Lamborghinis, to be fair. Even a white Lamborghini that is basic with no options and just basically built for one idiot that was going to lease it, that car is not going to be worth anything. It's going to depreciate, and it's going to be a very dangerous asset, you know, because it's a liability ultimately.
So what do you look for we can talk cars, but other assets. What is it that you're looking for, and how did you learn and hone in that art of finding the thing that's going to appreciate in value rather than the inverse?
So, I mean, it was a couple of things. First off, production numbers is what really matters, is exclusivity. That's the one thing that's become the new lineup for everything in the world is exclusivity. Meaning, like, if the more exclusive something is, the less people are there, the more people will fight over it. And I didn't learn that through, like, reading something. I learned that through trial and error. I spent years just, like, learning the markets and learning what's happening, but also created this model as I went along in the model myself. So it was a lot of trial and error, and it was also a lot of paying attention to what's happening as it's happening. You know, the industry, the automotive industry, has changed while I was in it. So it was different than people who are from the outside looking and saying, I wish that opportunity was there then. You know, I was adapting very fast and finding ways to make exclusivity matter more for people. And so that's why it gave birth to, you know, our investment fund.
And so... Why is it that the cars you were picking up, why is it that the owners that you were buying the cars from, the ones that are going to appreciate in value, didn't know what they were sitting on? Or are those owners in a particular state as well?
Oh, they knew, but most people, remember, there's a different purpose for people for different things. Someone buys a Ferrari to drive one, someone buys a Ferrari to race one, someone buys a Ferrari because they want to collect one. Different people have different reasons for owning cars. In value, this is something very important in business. Price is irrelevant. Value is subjective to the person buying, right? Meaning something is more valuable to me than it might be to you. I might look at a yellow car and I might be like, this is the car to own because they only made three. You may look at that yellow car and be like, I really like the way the yellow shines in the sun. I enjoy driving it out on the avenue and getting some, you know, dinner with my wife. Okay, we're looking at the car from a different perspective, right? We both enjoy the yellow, but we're not understanding the same model by looking at the same yellow, right? So as a result of that, we have an opportunity to both successfully be there with the model, you know?
Nice. And so how was it that you, we're talking about very, very specific types of buyers, right? We're not talking about general buyers. We're talking about very specific people with a certain level.
No, we're talking about anyone that wants an investment. I mean, think about it. We were selling investments. We weren't selling cars, right? That's the part you have to understand. Like, you're when you're selling investments, you're teaching people to invest in things. Do you really care the stocks that you buy? Do you really give a shit about the companies? Like, oh, who's the CEO? Most people buy stocks they don't even know the CEO of. They don't even know if there is a CEO in that fucking company. So there's some dude holding his dick sitting in his office, like pretending to own a $1 billion business based on a valuation that someone else gave him. They care about the money they're going to make, right? People, that's how they make investments. They don't care about the right investors care. The ones that are jumping in the gun trying to make money, they don't give a shit. They're not spending hours and hours studying the companies, its history. You know what I mean? They're just looking at it and going, hey, what can I make? Well, if you put it in this, you'll make 20%. Sounds good to me. Don't matter that the guy's selling arms to Korea or what. I don't give a shit. As long as it's legal and we're making money.
So in this case, what you're teaching your students then is how to spot the opportunity to buy an asset, in this case a car, that's going to appreciate and
correct.
They're going to get to enjoy, do the majority of them actually enjoy driving the car as well, as opposed to just putting it in their man cave?
Correct. That's exactly.
And so this was a model that continued with the watches and the art as well?
Correct. Yeah. Art, watches, and cars. And watches are more cash intensive, but same thing, ultimately.
Okay, and so how do you, going back to my question before, which I realize probably I framed a little bit wrongly, so I'm gonna frame it in a different way. This is still a world, like the buyers of those assets, the people that care less about kind of what whatever research says it's worth, and more, and they care more about, do you know what, there's only three in the world, and so I want to buy them at this price. How did you position yourself so that you could find and communicate with these kind of elusive and exclusive buyers?
Well, because remember, I was in banking, so I started somewhere. So I already had investors that were putting money in the bank. And this was a time where nobody wanted to have their money in the bank. So I gave them a channel to put it in after. It started there. And then the more I drove these cars, the more I came, had this conversation from a parallel standpoint with people. You have to understand that I was walking up to people saying, I'm a Lamborghini owner and I'm giving you a tip as a Lamborghini owner. And that held a lot of weight for people.
I
Get
can
it?
see that.
So when you're like, most people are afraid of showing who they are, right? They go, oh my God, I have all this money. I don't want my clients to know I'm rich. You know, I want them to think I'm struggling. Then I think of it and I go, well, wait a minute. Why would I be struggling? If I'm successful at what I do, I want everybody to know I'm successful at it, right? Make
And
sense? So
it
that's kind
absolutely
of the
does.
problem. Give
And
me one
so
second.
you're drawing them towards you because they're seeing the success and they're wanting a piece of it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have a hard stop at 11, so I want to make sure I get to your questions.
Not a problem. So I think this is a so, by the way, it's 11 o'clock, 6 minutes time.
Yep, you have about 10 minutes because I can be 5 minutes late. That's fine.
Right, we better do this fucking quickly then, PJ. Right, okay then. Let's pivot and go into it. So, question number one are the rapid fire questions. Are there any unusual things you eat or drink regularly, and why?
I drink 12 cups of cappuccino a day.
God damn. And you
A
sleep
day,
like a
yeah, I know.
baby?
And I'm lucky I'm still alive doing that shit.
But you still sleep at night, or do you do an inverse
Oh
thing?
yeah, I go to sleep at 3, I wake up at 6 every day. Like I get 3 to 4 hours of sleep.
Okay, you're not taking 12 cups of melatonin to like balance out
No, it's just
the caffeine. Okay. Right. How do you get yourself into a state of flow?
into a state of what?
Into a state of flow.
A flow? Music.
What kind of music?
Very bizarre music that's actually like, I don't know if you know the movie The Arrival or Game of Thrones or some of these, they
Yeah,
have
we've
very
heard of
epic
Game of
music.
Thrones, yeah. Yeah?
Yeah, like orchestra type music, etc. That gives me a lot of peace and allows me to kind of get in the mode.
Do you know, I feel you there, and I have three playlists on my Spotify, which is like motivating, inspirational, almost like movie soundtracky
Yeah,
type
like exactly.
of
Mood
things.
soundtracks, I think, are the best way to,
Love it.
reflective soundtracks, yeah.
What habit or opinion do you have that people tend to disagree with?
That I don't believe in right and wrong in the world. I believe in choice. Even in the most extreme cases, someone could argue that murder is wrong, and I would argue them all day that it's not.
And what would your argument be?
My argument would be that it's a choice based on time, and that without understanding the time structure that led to the action, we can't judge the action.
Okay, so you're not saying murder is right, you're just saying it might not
Well, I'm not
necessarily
saying
be
it's
wrong.
right or wrong. That's the
Yeah.
thing. Most people would define it. I would not, you know?
But you're reserving judgment until all the facts are in.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. If you ran a school but could only teach one non-traditional lesson, what would that be?
awareness
Awareness of what?
and the difference between self-awareness and awareness. Most people think it's the same thing. Awareness is your ability to understand your environment. Self-awareness is your ability to understand your capacity within the environment.
And which is more important?
Self-awareness, because without knowing the self, we can't change the belief.
Nice. What book or books had the biggest impact on your life?
Never read a book in my life.
Listened to one? Watched one?
Nope.
No? And
nope,
yet you've
never.
written 12 of them.
Yes. I
Yourself.
hate reading. I cannot read a book. I tried reading The Alchemist. I got like three quarters there and I fucking gave up. I was like, I love the idea. I just can't fucking read a book.
So where do you learn from?
Paying attention. The eyes. Like the more you pay attention to your environment, you actually realize that everything's already in front of you. You just have to pay attention to what's happening.
What does the first 30 to 60 minutes of your day look like, and at what time do you wake up?
Wake up early, always shower, always breakfast, no matter what, never miss it. Email, and then straight to my man cave so I can have an hour of no one calling me time.
And do you do anything in that time? Meditate, visualize, any of that?
No. I just get rid of all the shit that I don't want to do, like that I want to do, so that way the rest of the day can be productive and I'm not stuck browsing Instagram or whatever. You know, like, so I get rid of all that shit within the hour.
Have you got any advice for your previous boss or bosses in general?
That's a really good question. And no, I wouldn't give them any piece of advice because they, you know, one of the things I learned about corporate America and those people is that they're there because they like the security of the authority they've been given, right? They like the structure. And so the problem is when you are living in a game of structure, you're living in a game of fear all day. And anyone that is driven by fear will never be driven by purpose. So therefore, I can't give any piece of advice to anyone whose entire life is stuck in a box of fear. What I can tell people that are in leadership positions across the globe for whatever they do is that without the investment in your people, leadership isn't based on authority. It's about the human capital that you're willing to invest in. And if you don't pay attention to human capital, you'll quickly realize that you'll lose your greatest resource.
Where do you go or what do you do to get inspired?
Just watched my mom struggle through her life and never make an excuse why things couldn't happen.
If I gave you $5,000, how would you double it in 24 hours?
I'd buy a watch.
A particular watch?
Yeah, I'd buy a watch that I know would, that I can sell instantly for, 20% more.
Nice. What's the best advice ever given to you?
Stop giving a shit about what other people think.
Love it. What silly thing should people do more of?
Silly? Fuck. I don't think it's silly, but they should fuck more.
Oh, right. Fuck was the answer.
If they fuck more, they'll have less of an issue. They'll be happier in their life, I promise you. I've always had this rule. The more you fuck, the happier you are. Look at any guy that's always fucking. He's never unhappy.
Would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
Yeah, one duck.
Why?
Because I'd rather conquer the greatest and fiercest of enemies first, so that way I don't have to conquer 100 cockroaches. There's value in beating a giant boss rather than beating 100 peasants.
Get it. And then final question, PJ. What makes you happiest?
Purpose and meaning. Most people seek happiness in external things. I seek meaning. I seek happiness in progress. Progress leads to growth. Growth leads to happiness.
Amazing. Wow. Well, we really did go through those questions fast, but your answers were boom, boom, boom. Amazing. PJ, thank you so much for taking the time, sharing your story with the audience today, sharing your wisdom and your experience. I'm truly grateful for it. And I'm absolutely certain this is going to be a fantastic episode that people will love re-listening to. Thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate you having me on, buddy. Talk soon, okay?
Hey, Martin here again with an audio goodie bag of a bonus before you head off. First up, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please subscribe and follow Smarter Destiny across iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. It really helps spread our message, and you'll get valuable content along the way too. Secondly, if you have an e-commerce business or are thinking of starting one, grab a copy of my new book, 1% Secret, recommended by Kevin Harrington and a host of other elite guys. Even better, it's free. Just help out with the shipping costs. So head to smarterdestiny.com/book to grab your free copy. Thanks so much, and I'll see you on the next episode.